From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 614, SQL Server 2019 with guest Brent Ozar. Recorded Monday, October 15th, 2018. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio, bringing back one of my favorites today.
Dang.
I'm going to use your short bio here. Brent loves making SQL Server faster, more reliable, and you can find him at brentozar.com. That is a short bio.
Howdy, sir. Oh. I try to do the elevator pitch thing. Yeah. And even either people would get, oh, he works with SQL Server, or, okay, yeah, no. The more words I throw in there, it's only going to make things worse.
I'm totally with you. And I find myself writing different bios for different occasions, too.
Yes. I love the exercise of telling your family, explaining to your family what you do.
Because
you don't want to end up fixing the printer.
Yep.
You know, you don't want to be fixing someone's phone.
No.
And the way I love explaining it to people is, well, you know how you go to your favorite website and you buy something, and if it's moving too slow, you kind of get frustrated with it and you go off to something else. I'm the kind of person who helps to make sure that the data is moving around fast enough that you don't leave the website.
I remember my accountant asked me about problems he was having in his office with computers. And I'm trying to, we were going around, I was just trying to explain to him, like I kind of have a performance tuning expert for web and stuff like that. And he's like, how about this? I make F1 race cars go fast. You're bringing me a Toyota Tercel. I don't know what to do for you.
Yeah, it's. I also hope to put it in perspective that the software that I work on is generally $250,000 and up.
Yeah.
You know, just for the licensing kind of thing. So my ability to make a $20 shareware program go faster on $500 for the hardware, yeah. I just don't have it.
I don't know that. Yeah, I'm not efficient that way.
I'm not there.
You know? Yep.
And there's things that I expect to have in place when I come in. I expect the storage to be fast. There's things that used to be able to fly in the old days. We could get by with hard drives and stuff like that. Today, these days, with as much as SQL Server licensing costs and as much as database-related people cost, you know, you expect a certain amount of hardware to be in place. If you're still running an Etch-a-Sketch in the year 2018, I can't really help you.
Plus, I've got to imagine anybody's calling you in. Like, there are no unsupervised SQL servers in your life. I've got to imagine anybody calling you has a team, and they're looking for support at an expert level.
You know, it's really interesting. A lot of our clients come in from shops that are all developers, so like startup.coms. And SQL Server will let you go a really long way without adult supervision.
Interesting.
You can hit a pretty big wall performance-wise. You can go a long way before you run into problems. And this is also one of the times that I love about the cloud is that with the cloud, sure, you can turn up the knob to spend more and more money per month, and you can mask code problems for a longer and longer period of time.
Yeah.
But then you hit a certain point where you're like, okay, it's time to call in some adult supervision. You know, let's go figure out what's going on with this thing and get past the next level so we can make it cheap and fast instead of just fast.
Well, I mean, the good news about that, and I've certainly had this experience doing web performance tuning too, which is like whatever you charge is irrelevant to the equation.
Yes. Yes.
I remember literally hauling millions of dollars out of a hardware buy by doing optimizations architecturally. And then looking the company in the eye and saying, how about you just give me half what you're not going to spend next year? How about that?
Yes. I used to work for a company that did the same thing for telecom bills. They would work with hotels and say, they'd come in with their briefcases and they'd say, show me your teleconference bills, your you know, long distance bills, your collect call bills, all that stuff. They would lay out in a hotel room for like a day, sketching out all the things going on with this bill. And then they would go back to the hotel company and say, all right, we can cut your bills by $250,000 next year. If we can guarantee that we can do it, can we have X percentage of this?
Right.
I firmly believe that we're probably 6 to 18 months away from companies being built around doing that same thing in the cloud.
Sure.
That they'll walk in and go, all right, show me your Azure bill or AWS bill or Google bill. I'll sign an NDA. I'm going to sit in a room, you know, for 24 hours or whatever looking at this bill. And I'm going to figure out how much money I can save you and get a chunk of that. And the company won't care how quickly the consultant is able to do it. Just wow, you can cut $100,000 off my bill. Let's do this.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Especially if you can guarantee that end users aren't going to notice, because that's what we're all scared of.
Sure. Right?
Someone just turns down the server to too small of a horsepower. And sure, you saved a lot of money, but you know, all your customers are gone.
Well, yeah. You don't want to get into that pattern that the airlines got into, where they were so keen about saving every pound, you just started cutting services, right? No more magazines. Took the olives out of the meal, like all of that kind of silliness, and you could easily get into that trap. Measurement is hard, though. Like, actual quality of service, that's a tricky measure.
It sure is. And it's not like we were good at it when the stuff was on-premises.
Yeah.
You know, we sucked at it when it was on-premises, and we're going to suck at it up in the cloud, too. It's just that the ability to get a refund quickly, you know, to cut your bills quickly, that's what gets companies more excited. Because on-premises, they bought the $1 million worth of server, and that was the end of it. It just sat in there, whether you were using it or not.
Yeah. Well, and I do find, and certainly it's an ongoing conversation in RunAs, is folks are coming up to the renewal of those contracts or the replacements of those machines, and they're looking at that capital expenditure compared to what they're going to spend OpEx in cloud and going, can I really justify that buy this time around?
And it changes startups too. I mean, of course, if you're going to go startup, you're not going to do some big, huge $1 million CapEx purchase. You're just going to try and get by as long as you can with a credit card. But one of my customers says, you know, look, this every month I'm maxing out my personal credit card on our SQL Server bill just up in the cloud. What can you do to stop me from maxing that out? And oh, that brings it home. That makes it really personal.
So very real.
Yeah.
So with that all in mind, dude, why do we ever need to upgrade SQL Server again? Like, isn't it done? Isn't it perfect? Like, haven't you got it by now?
It's funny. I wonder, I talk to a lot of people who have that same feeling that once they've got it on premises and installed or up in the cloud or whatever, there's a cost to changing versions.
Yep.
It costs real money to change versions. Even if it's free to you, it still takes real human time to go move it from one place to the other.
And risk.
Yes.
You're taking stuff that works and you're messing with it. That is like rule number one of IT. If it ain't broke, man, like, what are you doing?
Yeah. And I think Microsoft really hit that too. There was a time when during the 2005-2008 days, they tried to get people to upgrade by throwing more free toys in the box.
Yeah.
Like they would say, all right, you've got reporting services now, and you've got integration services, and you've got analysis services, and all these things help you do more with the same stuff that you already paid for.
Right.
And it seemed like it worked really well. It got people excited to go, oh, I can do analytics now. I better upgrade to the new version in order to get that. But I think over time, what happened as we hit past 2008, 2012, people started going, I don't have any more manpower to use all these new features. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, you could keep adding more features in, and I really have enough features for now. So what they seem to have done, I really liked how they did it, but what they seem to be doing, and starting with 2017 and now with SQL Server 2019 as it ships, is when you upgrade, we'll make your code run faster.
Right.
And then people are like, oh, go on, tell me more,
because
no one has the time to rewrite all this legacy code.
Yeah. So you're not only not going to break anything I'm currently running, but what I get out the other side is better.
Yeah. And of course, that's the sales pitch, right?
You're
like, oh, don't worry, it's trust-free. Everything just runs faster.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always true either. There's going to be some sets of code that just doesn't run as fast as it used to.
Except for your code.
Yeah. It's always a gamble.
The
risk is always a gamble. But
sure,
that at least is the carrot they're using now to get you to move, to go, now, if you just go up here, it's going to suddenly start running faster. There's other features that they're throwing in the box, too. They're throwing in big data clusters. They're throwing in one that kind of makes my head scratch, the ability to run Java inside SQL Server.
Because running .NET inside a SQL Server wasn't that good an idea, you know, back in 2005.
Right.
And so it's like, now that we have this bad idea for a decade, let's give you a new bad idea.
I don't get it.
Yeah.
There are some things I don't get. There must be a big customer somewhere that's like, look, I'm not switching from Oracle until you can give me Java inside the database.
Yeah.
I've got millions of dollars that I would like to spend on my bad ideas. I would like you to empower me.
Well, and you know, I'm working on this history of .NET thing. So I have talked to the team that did that initial implement of .NET in 2005. And you're exactly right. It was specific customers who had specific problems that thought this would be the solution for it. And I think it helped them But there are better solutions today. I mean, it's been 13 years, 14 years, right?
Which leads to an interesting question. If you were one of those customers with tons of money, you know, let's say that someone takes a fairy wand to you and anoints you the CTO of some ginormous company.
Right.
I was going to say Sears, but that's probably a bad example.
Yeah, not a good choice. Yeah.
Yeah. Not the best one today.
That's not a good choice, man. You're not going to make your story work. Just say it.
I'm going to fight back with the fairy wand. Don't touch me with that wand.
Yeah, get away.
If they anointed you one, like what would be the features that you would ask for? What would be the thing you would ask for out of a database? What changes would you want made?
Well, at every time, the simple rule is faster, right? I mean, that's the apocryphal. If I'd asked the customer what he wanted, he would have said faster horses, right?
Yes.
Which apparently Henry Ford never said, but it's a great statement. It's like it is very simple to say, give me more of what I've got.
Yeah. I think if you made me do one, faster, of course, is always good for me. But I would love to be able to say we could run Oracle applications as is with no changes.
Right.
Like any, you know, whatever language that they want to use will work exactly the same in SQL Server as it does in Oracle. I think that would be pretty compelling.
Being able to shift a workload in situ and have it simply function. Hopefully faster or at least less expensive.
Yeah.
That's going to engage folks. That's something they're going to care about.
I don't know how I would want to be so possessive of give me that workload. You know, I want that workload and be able to run it under SQL Server. Whereas I wouldn't look at MySQL or Postgres and say we need to run those apps as is because I get that where Microsoft is coming from, that there's money in Oracle and there's not as much money in MySQL or Postgres.
Right.
If you had to let me pick a magic wand workload and go, what features would you get? I'd rather just run Oracle queries as is. Java, I'm like, I don't really have a compelling reason to go run Java apps as is.
It seems like a special case, but yeah, I totally get that. You are talking about any people that are bound to existing workloads that run those things. I do like this philosophy, and maybe I'm extrapolating too much, but just looking at stuff that Asad Khan and stuff have said, I'm starting to feel like there's this idea that storing data is a role and a responsibility inside of an organization, irrespective of how it's stored. And it seems like SQL Server is morphing into this, what is it you need to store? We can help you.
Yeah, and there was a tool in SQL 2019 that I like a lot is the data classification feature.
Mm-hmm.
I really want the ability to say these parts of my database are the parts that need to be secure. These are the parts that are not allowed to go as is to the development environment. You know, whenever we do a restore,
right?
These are things that are personally identifiable. And it feels like they're only putting the bones or the skeleton in at first to just let us classify that data. But I think this is one of those huge moments that 5-10 years from now, we're going to look back and go, oh, thank God we had the ability to classify data.
So almost like data privacy constraints that you can embed directly into your schema.
Yeah.
I like that.
Of course, there's no action taken on it yet.
No.
That's still left as a roll your own kind of thing. But at least we're just starting to get there. Because this data role, the data hosting role, is also going to involve a data privacy role, a data security role with the GDPR, with all these crazy expensive regulations that go in.
And you know there's only more of them coming.
And they're all going to be freaking different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it's terrible. So it's going to be somebody's role, just like a data accountant, you know, chief financial officer type thing, where somebody has to be able to assess and take an inventory of what is it we own? Where is it? Who has access to it?
Sure.
And right now it sucks so bad. It's such manual work, so painful. And I get that if SQL Server can do a great job of that, it makes it easier for the CXOs to say, well, why don't we just start putting stuff in SQL Server more often? Because it's easier for us to control it there, whereas our MySQL guys have no idea.
And especially if it has a set of compliances already in place, it just say, if it's there, then you are compliant. You know, Microsoft's done a good job with that with Azure for certain marketplaces where it's like, I need this kind of compliance. It's like, well, if you use these services in Azure, you are compliant with anything that simplifies that audit. As you know, somebody who's done a non-trivial amount of work in financial services, where we were able to point at is, you know, stuff like PCI. If I use this transaction processor, they handle the PCI requirements for me. That's a big pain point off my InfoSec guy. It's like, that's done, right?
And the risk, just another, just a huge risk in dealing with databases. And as a data professional, how do you even start knowing what parts are secure and what parts are not? You know, where does that even begin? So the fact that they've added that, that's another one that I think will drive adoption.
And it's great to hear you describe it as early days. Like,
yeah,
that means there's several more versions or at least patches coming down the pipe to try and get good at this.
There have to be, because I think identifying the data is only the first part of the problem. Mm-hmm. Then you have to correctly secure it. And we don't have anything remotely resembling the ability to say, if the data classification matches this, then it must be secured. And here's how you go about securing it. But it's baby steps. It's a baby step I like the direction of.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about that being an architectural thing. We're all doing this in one degree or another inside of organizations, especially when it's like providing data to developers to experiment on, where it's like, I need to sanitize this and move it over to you guys so it doesn't violate any privacy requirements, which you tend to do sort of once and then leave it.
And you see it so much with the data science crew these days. There's so many people who go, I want direct access to the production data so I can go run experiments against it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that immediately makes all the security people in the audience cringe.
Yeah. No, we all sit up, put our tinfoil hats on, and look over stick glaringly.
Yes. Trust me, no one's ever going to see your personally identifiable data, but it's happening all the time out there. And just the ability to identify for the people on the front end when they're building a system to go, these are the parts that no one else should see. These are the parts that are private, you know, and you're going to need to mask later.
Yeah.
So that later when you hand off the data to data science professionals, it's easier to go, all right, these are the parts that I'm going to mask before I hand it over to you.
They're already sanitized. I love everything about that. And Brent, I got to interrupt you for just a moment for this very important message. Did you inherit a SQL Server? And I don't mean the good kind of inheritance, like your grandparents left it to you. I mean in a bad way, like someone left your company and left you with a slow, unreliable database server. Find out what you're up against. Go to BrentOzar.com and get a free set of scripts to run a SQL Server health check. It'll take less than 5 minutes, and it's totally free. Go to BrentOzar.com. And we're back. It's Run As Radio. Richard Campbell here talking to Brent Ozar. Ozar Unlimited, and we're talking a little SQL Server 2019.
Yes.
It's interesting with them including Hadoop and Spark sort of in the package, especially since Hadoop's now been merged with another entity too. So all this data analytics side is getting complicated.
I'm really curious. So they still haven't said anything on public on the record about how's licensing going to work?
Yeah.
Because of course, Microsoft has always been about how can we throw more free tools in the SQL Server box? How can we put more value in? But you don't buy a one server Hadoop solution.
No.
Ain't nobody build a Hadoop cluster with one VM in it. You know, you're going to build a big, ginormous, burstable. And it's also very much about how can you burst and stretch out to accommodate temporary workloads, shrink back down. That is not the licensing model for SQL Server. That has never been the licensing model. I don't know how this is going to go down.
Yeah. That's very interesting part to think about is that really cloud behavior, you know, before cloud was really a thing, the whole MapReduce stuff that Google wrote about was this, hey, you're going to virtualize everything. You can expand across as many devices as possible, do a workload and consolidate, reduce it down and wrap it back up again.
Mm-hmm. And there's no licensing accountability in SQL Server today. It was one of the classic 101 level questions that you see on forums. Hey, where can I see where my license is installed at? And it just doesn't work that way. It's kind of an honor system in that you can install as many of the stuff as you want, but then later you're going to have to pay for it, you know, on the back end with true ups or enterprise licensing. But
which I've always appreciated from that angle when I've been talking to customers and they're like, well, we don't know if this will work. It's like, for testing purposes, just install it. Like, you're not in violation of license if it's for a test.
And developer edition's free.
Yeah.
And it's fully capable.
Yeah. And but the only enforcement then is at the audit.
Yes. Yeah. I got to imagine if they're really going to do this, you know, grow and shrink big data clusters deal, there has to come a point where they introduce some kind of accounting, whether it's, I'd love to pay per core by the hour.
Yeah.
You know, you've got clients, I'm sure, who do the holiday bursts, who have the Black Friday sales, and they only need big power for short periods of time, but then they'd love to be able to turn it back off and go cheaper for a while.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, name me a SQL Server that doesn't have that variability workload, really. I think it's relatively rare.
People would love the ability to do it in daytime versus nighttime.
Sure.
That would be phenomenal as well.
I remember those old Unisys systems where they actually could re-architect the core implementation. So it's like, during the day, most of the cores are allocated to mail processing, and during the night, they're mostly allocated to OLAP processing. Like,
yeah.
What if we could have a dynamic licensing model like that? Or do we just transform licensing into, as a whole? Like, it's harder and harder to hang on to this per-core licensing model in this age of open source.
Yes.
And software as a service models.
You hear all the containers chanting. It's almost like a drumbeat coming out of Microsoft these days. Containers, containers, containers.
Sure.
Especially around the SQL Server team. I don't yet see a really strong use case for SQL Server running containers in production workloads. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense there. But when you go do the big data clusters thing, where you're suddenly talking about breaking out large workloads temporarily across short periods of time, we got to have some other method for licensing than you're buying 40 cores and mortgaging your house for the next 3 years.
Yeah.
There has to be something else.
Yeah, it's just not feasible. The container story is really interesting because this seems to me like the first version of SQL Server thinking container. And it makes me go back to like the 2012 edition, which to me felt like the first one where they really thought about virtualization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because SQL Server generally resisted virtualization for a long time. You know, some of my earliest RunAs shows in 2008, 2009, is like, would you ever virtualize SQL Server? Of course I wouldn't. That's not something you would do. That's crazy talk.
Yeah. And you got to believe that sooner or later, containers will be a bigger deal for production servers than they are today. We're not there yet, but
no,
super, super early. And I haven't seen the problems. Virtualization solved a really large problem, which was companies were so sick and tired of buying a big piece of iron and having it sit at 10% utilization for weeks on end.
Yeah. Well, and to me, it seems like the container solution is the automation environment for bursting workloads.
And health and repairability, you know, the forums are all chock full of people going, I had a problem applying service pack, whatever. You know, and instead of troubleshooting it, of course, the container idea is you just spin up something new. You just replace it. The engine is usually replaceable fairly quickly. But in order to get there, we've got to stop treating our database servers like pets and start thinking of them as cattle, you know, the cloud saying. But right.
Sure. But that's also really challenging
because
data is unique.
Yeah.
Is that unicorn? Is a pet? It's an asset of the organization.
Yeah. Especially the way that we tend to treat database servers as, well, I'm just going to customize this thing just the way that I want, set up 5 link servers and 3 agent jobs, and I'm not going to put any of it in source control because that's just way entirely too hard. Instead, I'm just going to hope and pray that this thing never fails.
Yeah. Well, don't worry. I'll write out all the steps I use to click on those different boxes in Word.
Yes, I will take screenshots in Paint.
And embed it in the Word document, because that'll always be right. That would never change. Goodness knows.
Unbelievable. And that was our life for like 20 years. And that's exactly how databases work.
Yeah.
And the sysadmins are so far ahead. God bless y'all who are sysadmins listening to this. You're so far ahead with all of your PowerShell scripting and automation and how can I save the script for this so that I never have to do it again? You would think, I know when I was in a sysadmin, I'm like, you would think that DBAs would be a level above that, and we're not. When it comes to databases, we're like 5 levels behind.
We got trapped in an intermediary layer. It was because of data modification language, because we had our own semi-scriptable solution, and we always managed scripts. But they became these magic fairies. It was its own thing, being a master of the scripts. We got stuck in a backwater.
Because we as database administrators weren't really into source control, our source control was like a file on a server somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, new server underscore 14 or new server underscore the new one.
Yeah. The new one rev 2. Rum rev 2 update. New Rum rev 2 final. Yeah. Who would do that? Whoever does that. But I totally agree. We got into that particular trap. There's a part of me that's thinking about writing a book called DevOps, When to Have the Party.
Go on.
It's like one of the best times to have a party is when operations people come to dev and say, teach us about this source control you speak of. Like the moment you realize that you are writing chunks of code that are important enough that they need to be in a repository, version controlled, and blame managed.
Yeah.
It's a milestone in your thinking, and it's worth having a beer over.
Oh, you're so right, too, because it is a moment that the ops people have to go to dev. Dev can't come to ops and say, we want you to source control our infrastructure, because that doesn't work. They have to see the value in it. They have to have that moment where a server went down, or a region or an availability zone went down, and no one quite knows how to set things up the way they were set up before.
Right. Or we had it running beautifully, and then we made some changes, and now it's not running beautifully. And can you articulate those changes?
Yes. For the DBAs in the audience, the way to think about it is trace flags. So you could set up all kinds of weird trace flags on your SQL server, and you probably over the years set up a few, and you don't. If I told you to go look at them right now, you'd be like, oh, that's right. I did 4199 for that weird SAP support call. But it's never really documented in one place. It's not saved as part of your backups. And so when you go to build a brand new SQL server under duress because something broke, you're like, what trace flags did we have on? If you even think about trace flags, which most of us don't as we go build a new server.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be nice to have that kind of thing in some kind of source control somewhere where you could just say, here's, I know is the source of truth. Let's go build it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, the configuration is code mindset. And to have that penetrate the DBA world, that's a challenging concept.
Oh, man. Every agent jobs is another one.
Yeah.
People have agent jobs, and then they'll go to fail over to another server and go, wait, which ones of these were supposed to be enabled and which ones aren't supposed to be enabled? You know, no one's really sure. It is a very party-having mindset when someone finally comes in and says, I want to source control this, because source control is still not friendly.
No, no. And I don't know that it ever really will be. The only thing worse than source control is all the other options.
Yes. I'm doing a talk, an introduction to GitHub for SQL Server DBAs at Intersections in Vegas coming up.
Nice.
I'll see you out there. I know I'm just kind of bracing myself for walking in and having a completely empty room, or a room of people who don't want to be there, but have to be there, because their developers have said, we're sick and tired of the database being some kind of island that's unpredictable.
Yeah, and interesting to get to that point, which is that, you know, the byproduct of these instrumentation and regression models, where we're able to go back and test everything, say, hey, this is where we tend to fall down. How are we going to get better on this? What are the solutions to that?
As a DBA, too, whether you're DBA or sysadmin, your developers have been fighting this fight for a long time with their own code. They've all struggled for a really long time with source control. You're not alone, and there's a lot of good beginner getting started stuff out there. Know that it's not easy for anyone. It's easier for the developers than it is for us.
But arguably, they've just been spending longer with it. Right? They've just had this pain for more time.
They make it look easy just because they've been doing it for a long time, but it isn't easy for them. It is challenging for them as well. What a payoff.
Yeah, absolutely huge reward. And I've been on my campaign to say, banish the word easy from your nomenclature, because as soon as stuff works, it becomes easy and you start calling it that, but it's not true. You struggled. It was always hard. You know, it's a far better language to go, this is kind of a pain in the butt. It's difficult, but it's worth it. Let's go work on it.
I believe that the only time that a technologist thinks that something is easy is when it is currently working for them.
Absolutely.
But the instant that it breaks again, you know, for any other reason, they're like, oh my gosh, this is hard again.
It's so hard, yeah.
Easy is a temporary state in between failures. That's all it is.
And it's kind of a lie. So if you just stopped saying it, we'd be better off. You know, you're creating pain for yourself unnecessarily there.
Oh, it's a false faith in security in something. And I think you also, the more that you know about the internals of something, the less confident you become, the more you can feel like, you know, it's a miracle that any of this glue ever holds together on any given day.
So, yeah, there's nothing more certain than the junior guy who knows only one way to do something.
Yes.
The most confident person in the world. The more experience I get, the less I'm absolutely sure I have no idea what I'm doing. We're just making our way.
Anytime I look at a complicated, you know, modern web app, I'm like, it's amazing that I can click this button, my credit card gets charged, and something shows up on my desktop in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah.
And there are a huge mountain of cards underneath this that if one card falls over, we are screwed. It's so bad. I really am amazed. My hat is completely off to developers when I look at how many skills they have to learn every year and how those things change so much.
Yeah.
You take a database from 2005, take a database that was attached to a SQL Server 2005 server. You detach that, you reattach it to one of today's SQL servers, and it's going to work. And the queries are going to work the same way. The language you use to administer it works the same way. It's the same basic functionality. It's been in use for the last, 10, 15 years. You take a Visual Studio project from 2005 and you try to get that to compile and work today on a modern browser or computer, forget it.
Good luck, dude. Yeah, that's not an easy challenge. And especially the compromises we made back in those early days to make stuff work well. We just had that whammy in July, the hot fix they did on .NET that got pushed out in Windows Update was relying on a vulnerability that the team just believed nobody used until it took down Exchange and SQL Server and SharePoint, right? I mean, that their own internal organizations depended on this weird little thing that nobody uses. It happens. It happens a lot.
Development is really impressive. As an engineering career, it is so impressive that things continue to work. Whereas database administrators, a lot of us get comfortable and think, oh yeah, this stuff works pretty well, but it's only because it doesn't change anywhere near as often as development changes.
And some developers do that too. You can pick a skill set and a set of apps that have been built inside of an organization and sort of step off the treadmill and work on that set of tools for an extended period of time, because there's a question of whether or not it makes sense to perpetually modernize every app in your organization. If you've got an app that's internal, that the current set of capabilities are sufficient, you could make a career. Somebody could have jumped on ASP.NET in 2003 and be using those techniques and have ridden them now for 15 years.
Cold Fusion, same deal. I still every now and then hear people are like, yep. And they always say it with a tinge of regret. They're like, yeah, I have an app. It's in Cold Fusion. I know you're going to kill. I'm like, but it works, right? You're it making works, money on it. So that works for me.
But it seems to be the norm where that's a certain class of developers. A certain seems to be more of the norm for DBAs.
Yeah.
Because the conservatism
pays,
right? That is a good strategy. It's a good personality when your job is to be a steward of the data for the organization. That conservatism serves very well.
And that you're averse to risks.
Yeah.
That you're saying there is something new on the other corner. Virtualization was a great example of that, 10, 15 years ago. Oh my God, that's crazy. I could lose things when other servers are busy. So they were very conservative for a really long time. And then when it was finally well proven and you could run large apps on it, then gradually database administrators would let go and go, all right, let's play around with this. Containers will be the same deal. Today, troubleshooting containers is terrible. Authentication against them is terrible. Dealing with persistent storage is doable now, but doable enough to the point where most recent documentation still says you can't do it. You have to find new documentation. So it's just a matter of letting other people get in there, prove out the worth and value for regular applications, and then gradually let in the prize prince jewel of your entire portfolio, your data.
Yeah. And of course, then you take your low velocity data stores first and you'll move them. I remember creating VMs for SQL Server for this stuff that, it needed to be up, but it just wasn't that busy. But your primaries that had dedicated hardware and stuff, those went last.
And it's funny, I kind of think of it as the opposite with transactional front-end databases for stuff like websites.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, this is where Azure SQL DB, where Amazon RDS, this is where those kinds of things shine because they're so much better at uptime than we are.
Than we ever been, yeah.
Oh, man. I know so many people who are like, oh, I can't, who know, with the cloud, there's no point of contact. Yeah, it's because it hardly ever breaks. Because generally, when it's broken, it's your query that's broken. It's not the service itself.
And when they break, they knew they broke before you knew they broke. Yeah. And there's already a post up saying, here's the problem we're having. This is our expected time to remediate.
I really love when we talk about outage times with customers, I'll say, look, you're going to fall into one of two buckets. Either you're going to be so small that you can't get a point of contact and your point of escalation is just posting in a forum somewhere, or you're going to be so large that you get a dedicated account manager,
right?
In which point you're going to be calling them and they're not really going to have anything to tell you anyway. They're working as fast as they can in order to get it fixed. But the beauty of being up there is that when one of those big provider goes down, you're not the only down application.
No.
That there are other large down applications. And your own customers will generally understand if there's an outage that took down all of Azure South Central, for example, and your application is down. Generally, you can point to Microsoft status pages and go, see, we're not the only ones affected here. This is a big deal.
Yeah. No, and I've said this out loud. Maybe it's grossly unfair. It's like the great thing about being in the cloud is it's not your fault.
Yes.
Yes. It makes the news. It's not your fault.
The bill is your fault. There's still, yes. You get to focus on performance tuning, which I think is so much more fun than dealing with outages. You can be a hero for making queries fast, but you're never a hero when the SQL server is just up. That's kind of table stakes. You should always be keeping the server up.
You only ever get a C for keeping it up.
Yes, yes.
You can get an F for having it down, but it's very hard to get an A. The A's are very transitory. They're those performance moments, and they're that. Yeah. There's also just the surviving a crisis, getting through a tough weekend, you know, those kinds of things.
I don't know about you, but I really miss that being a database administrator, system administrator, developer, etc. There is that rush in the resuscitate something from the dead.
Yeah.
There's a huge rush in walking in and going, I don't know what the answer is, but I'm going to find it and I will win. You know, we will bring this thing back up together.
Oh, sure. Well, remember, I was a performance guy for websites. So during the dot-com boom, like that was the job day in, day out was we are so successful that our servers are going down. Every time we try and stand them back up, before they can get running, they get punched back down again.
Yes.
But that's also its own kind of sickness, right? It's a rush, the same way, you know, jumping out of an airplane is a rush. It's just generally not a good idea. When we do our jobs really well, it should be dull.
Oh, right. But it's at least when you're brought in as a performance specialist, you know, it's the feeling of I'm going to turn it around. Now, if I lived here full time in this, you know, particular job, then it would be calm. But, you know, because I get to be brought in when things are on fire, then it's fun to constantly fix these mistakes.
Yeah. Now, and I used to open with that sort of congratulations. You have a good problem, right? Like if nobody was using your site, it would be up.
Yeah. Yeah.
You now have enough customers and enough enthusiasm that it's a problem. So now we're going to try and get over it.
And it's a profitable problem because the more you keep your site up, then the more money you'll be able to make. So it's a good time to be there.
Well, I don't know how well we've sold SQL Server 2019 on this show, Brent.
Well, this is one of those things where I love looking at people's code and going, okay, look, based on your use of table variables, the memory grants in your query, you desperately need batch mode. I mean, like there's several things that I can look at and say, you need to get on 2019 as fast as possible. In the past, I've always said you shouldn't go to a new version of SQL Server until you need to.
Right.
You know, I'd rather someone else iron out the bugs. This is, I think, the first version in maybe a decade where I've started picking clients out and going, you need to go because your code will genuinely benefit from these huge performance speedups without having to fix the code.
Now, upgrade or replace new hardware?
I'm always about, I would rather build a new one aside, just separate, completely separate, and go test your code on it, make sure that things actually work the way you expect. Plus, the last box was so dirty and disgusting from the last, I know it wasn't you, but the last sysadmin doing all kinds of dirty, crazy things on there that it's generally, when it's time to replace SQL Server, it's generally time to go replace the OS from scratch as well.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And it's and plus, you're going to get a chance to take on the next generation set of CPUs.
Yes.
Buy the RAM all at once and just acknowledge this is what we consume these days. It's all very fair.
And even when you're on a VM, just the confidence of, I'm going to build a brand new VM from scratch. I'm going to know exactly how it's configured and prepared. I'm going to document everything and script it all out this time so that when things go to, you know, Hades in a handbasket, I'm going to be better prepared.
Yeah. Then using Boxstarter and all of those kinds of tools, Vagrant, so that you do have literally a script from launch the VM, configure it with this OS, set these settings, install this software in this order, these settings, so that you can make configuration as a code work with a virtual machine. It's just not easy.
Yep.
It's one of the arguments I have for containers. It's like containers are configuration with code thought of at the beginning, not later.
It's true. Yeah. And it forces you to do it that way.
Yeah, there's no other way to do it.
Forces you.
Brent, it's always fun to talk to you.
You too, Richard.
And appreciate your insights. And so we're going to see you at
Intersections. Yeah. Heading out to Vegas in December that we're out there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Looking forward to that. Anytime I get to drive rental cars around in the desert in Vegas and go at high speeds, I'm all about that.
They back up faster than any other kind of car. And they go over speed bumps faster, too. I found it astonishing, really.
It's pretty remarkable. And I don't have to feel guilty about it afterwards.
Yeah, just give it back. Thank you again for coming on the show.
Thanks. My pleasure, man.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.